Today is October 25th. I believe it's our third class in Theodicy and Providence in post-Holocaust Jewish thought. We've been learning Faith After the Holocaust by Professor Eliezer Berkowitz. And in order to review what we did until now, I thought we would open up the Talmudic passage that he's been partially basing his claims upon. We read the passage in his paraphrase, but we'll read the passage now in its original, again, just to remind ourselves, there's nothing new there. However, we'll see that there is a earlier part of this same passage that Professor Berkowitz didn't quote and didn't talk about. We'll look at that earlier part after we look at the later part that he did quote, and it'll turn out that that earlier part actually sheds further light on his argument. So, here we go. This is Babylonian Talmud Tractate Yoma 69b. That's Jim's, and that's yours. So the part that Professor Berkowitz has been working off of is at the bottom of this one side that I gave everyone. And as you can see, at the top of my sheet, it says we're working with pages 107 and henceforth in Professor Berkowitz's Faith After the Holocaust. And here is the Talmudic passage that he's quoted as been working on. Rav Matana said, second paragraph of the sheet. He said, and the reference is to Ezra in the book of Nehemiah. Remember, Ezra was the great sofer, the great scribe / rabbi, who helped the Jewish community come back from Babylonia to the land of Israel to build the temple, the second temple. We're talking about the year 105-10 before the Common Era, approximately 510, 520 before the Common Era. And here in the book of Nehemiah, in chapter 9, verse 32, Ezra is saying concerning God, the great, the mighty, and the awful. Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vanora. We had it on the board last time. With those three adjectives, great, mighty, and awful, or awesome. For Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, why then were they called the men of the great assembly? Ezra, in tradition, is known to be the head of the assembly of rabbis of that day, and we call them Anshei Knesset Hagdullah, the men of the great assembly. Ask Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, why were Ezra and his rabbinic legislator called legislative, why were they called the men of the great assembly? Why not just the assembly? By the way, there were 120 rabbis there. That's why the Knesset today in Israel has 120 leaders.
I thought there were 70.
No, there were Shivim Zkenim, right? In the book of Numbers, in the Torah, there are 70 elders. But in the book of Ezra, talking again about the beginning of the Second Temple period, what's called Shivat Zion, the return to Zion, there were 120. Anshei Knesset Hagdolah. Why were they called the men of the great assembly? Because they restored the crown of divine attributes to its ancient completeness, as the Talmudic passage now goes on to explain. For Moses had come and said, the great, the mighty, and the awesome, that's in Deuteronomy chapter 10, that line that we say in our Shmona Asrei, Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vanara, with those three adjectives, it comes from the book of Deuteronomy. It was Moses that called God with the words great, mighty, and awesome. Then Jeremiah came. Remember, Jeremiah is 1,000 years, almost 1,000 years.
More like
600, 700, perhaps 800 years after Moses. And in the book of Jeremiah, he doesn't refer to God as the great, mighty, and awesome. He refers to God using great and mighty, but not using the word awesome. Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor. But he doesn't say the word Nora. Awesome. As it says here, then Jeremiah came when this first temple was being destroyed and said, aliens are destroying his temple. Where are then his awesome deeds? Hence he omitted the attribute, the awesome. Daniel came and said, and Daniel is another 50 or 100 years after Jeremiah. And on his day, he prayed the same prayer of Moses, but he left out not only the last adjective, he left out the second to last one also. He didn't say, God, great, mighty, and awesome. He left out awesome, but he also left out mighty, and he just said, God, great. He left out another adjective. As the Talmud says, Daniel came and said, aliens are enslaving his sons. We are in Babylonian Persian exile. Where are his mighty deeds? Hence he omitted the word mighty. But they came and said, meaning Ezra and his rabbis, the men of the great assembly, they came and said, on the contrary, therein lie his mighty deeds, that he suppresses his wrath, that he extends long suffering to the wicked. Stop. Now the opposite is the case. It's not that in the world we're living in which the aliens are destroying his temple, and the aliens, meaning the goyim, are enslaving us, it's not that God is not showing his might and his awe. The opposite of the case. God is showing his might and his awe. God, by restraining himself and holding himself back, is showing great might and great awesomeness by having the power to stay quiet and not intervene when all these terrible things are happening. Again, this whole review of what we talked about last time. Right? So this is the source of the idea that the greatest strength in the world, at least vis-a-vis God, and also vis-a-vis human beings.
This thing from picking up on, you are strong, you control
right?
His passion.
Right, it's all related to here.
Yeah.
But God's greatness and awesomeness is that he has the absolute power to intervene, and he doesn't do so. He's able to hold himself back and to see the suffering that's caused on earth, and it causes God great suffering. According to many Midrashim, God is crying and God is in pain because he would like to intervene and save the righteous, but he can. Not that he can't, he can, but he's made a conscious decision not to. And we talked last time, according to Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, why not? Why did God decide not to? Why does God hide his face? And to summarize, we saw that according to Professor Berkowitz, God cannot intervene because he has decided that there's a higher value than intervention, than saving the righteous, a higher value than justice on earth, and that higher value is human autonomy. That higher value is giving us, human beings, the possibility of doing good. And the only way to do good
is to be free.
Is to be free to do bad. Right? And that's the principle. God wants a world that is good. But a world can't be good unless it chooses to be good when the option to be bad is there. A world that is good because it has no choice to be good, that's not good. That's not the definition of good. Good is a moral choice that has to be made by man, and man has to be free. And for man to be free, he has to have the possibility of doing evil and not being punished. Because were God to intervene at every moment, to use my famous word, were God to zap us, right, my favorite word, at every moment, we would completely lose the possibility of doing evil because of the paralysis of fear.
I have a question, yeah. For example, you said that the autonomy or the freedom to do good or bad, that is attributable to Hitler, but the people, their victims, they didn't have a choice to do good or bad. That's the problem there that I found.
Wait, that doesn't matter. For this argument, we're talking about God's relationship to the collective. God wants to give collective man the possibility of doing good, so there has to be evil. If the way man organizes society is to take autonomy away from individuals and make them into autonomous of the dictator, that's just another example of man doing bad with the autonomy he was given. Man can think of the worst evils given autonomy. He can think of evils God himself didn't even think of. Now, although we stopped in the middle of the passage, and Professor Berkowitz does go on with the passage, we're going to go on with it only another 5 minutes. We're going to take now an interlude and stop the passage in the middle and move to the beginning of the passage that Professor Berkowitz didn't quote. I mean the whole top paragraph. It's the same passage. When you see I have there three dots between the two passages, I only left out two lines. It's one continuous passage. And I really only realized 2 days ago that the beginning of the passage directly sheds light on the second half of the passage. Again, Professor Berkowitz didn't quote the beginning of the passage that we're about to look at now, but it really makes his point. And I'm pretty fascinated by that. I've now seen how two seemingly unconnected agadic passages that appear on the same page in the Talmud Bavli really have an underlying philosophical theme. So, the passage that Professor Berkowitz quoted, that we just read, talks about the fact that God holds himself back. Right? But it doesn't say why. The why was added by Professor Berkowitz, of why God restrains himself, to give us freedom. But the answer to the why is actually in the first passage. Unbelievable. Here we go. By the way, this is a passage that that came to mind in preparation for the class I'm giving Wednesday morning on love, lust, and longing in the Talmud. It's a passage that has to do with sexual relations, but it really bears directly on this issue. Here we go. And they cried with a great loud voice unto the Lord their God. Verse from Nehemiah, chapter 9, verse 4, only a few verses before the verse that was quoted at the bottom of the passage, also from Nehemiah, chapter 9. So it's a historical description. The Jews in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah coming back from Babylon exile to the land of Israel are crying out to God with a great loud voice. What did they cry? Asked the Talmud. Woe, woe, it is he who has destroyed the sanctuary, burnt the temple, killed all the righteous, driven all Israel into exile, and is still dancing around among us. And as the note at the bottom says, the he is not God. The he is the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse. It's the evil impulse that has destroyed the sanctuary, burnt the temple, killed all the righteous, driven all Israel into exile, and is still dancing among us. And we are, that is to say, the Jews of the time of Ezra, tremendously disturbed and perturbed that there's this Yetzer Hara, this evil inclination. Without it, none of these bad things would have happened. Again, the sense is that it's all our fault, right? But it's not our fault. It's the fault of that evil inclination that got into us. If only we could get rid of it. And then the Talmud says the following line. Thou, meaning God, they're talking to God, has surely given him, him is the Yetzer Hara, has surely given him to us that so we may receive reward through him. What does it mean?
We have a choice between whether to follow Yetzer Hara or to be good.
Right. God gave us the Yetzer Hara as a present, as a gift, because it's only because of the Yetzer Hara that we can gain reward. Gain reward by overcoming it and doing good and being rewarded by God. So what the Talmud's already saying is that with all the terrible, terrible, terrible tragedies that are caused by the Yetzer Hara, it really was given to us as a gift by God, because it allows us autonomous free choice. Had there been no desire for evil, therefore no possibility of doing evil, we would just be automatically good, then our good wouldn't be good. It would just be the good of a computer, of a robot. We wouldn't be rewarded for it. It wouldn't be called ethical good. And all the meaning of life, of overcoming challenges, overcoming the desire to do evil, and therefore and doing good, it wouldn't exist. So we understand that God gave it to us as a gift. But, the next line goes on, we want neither him nor reward through him. We don't want the Yetzer Hara, and we're willing to forgo the Yetzer Hara, which means forgoing its reward, which basically means we're willing not to be human. We're willing to forgo all of the challenges and the and therefore the successes of being good, because you know what? Because the world is just too bad. It's exactly the same thing that you would say after the Holocaust. We understand the tremendous value of free choice, but you know what? It's just too free. It's just, the option for evil is just too evil, and it's not worth it. And this is what the Jews are saying here just a few decades after the destruction of the first temple. We don't want the Yetzer Hara, we don't want its reward. Now, you think, wait a second, could they really be saying we're willing to forgo the whole project of being human? That actually means throw out the Torah, right? Throw out everything it means to be a human being. So it's not going that far, because it's only talking about, as the next few lines make it clear, it's only talking about a specific aspect of the Yetzer Hara. It's only talking about the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. It's not talking about the Yetzer Hara for anything else but idolatry. The Yetzer to search out more gods, to worship more forces to try and appease. The Yetzer to have a god who is tangible, who is right there, you can see and feel and cuddle. That's what it's talking about. And it's that Yetzer, that evil impulse, that caused the destruction of the temple, because we worship idols. And we were destroyed, therefore.
How do we know that it's a piece of Yetzer Hara? I mean, not all of it. I mean,
from the rest of the passage.
Oh.
We'll get to it.
Oh.
So you're saying we were responsible for the destruction of the temple because we didn't?
That's what the passage is assuming. That God brought upon us the Assyrian and the Babylonian armies because of punishment for idolatry. As, of course, the books of the prophets are full of the stories of idolatry in the First Temple period. So now, thereupon, a tablet fell down from heaven for them, whereupon the word truth was inscribed. We often find this in Talmudic stories, that God communicates by sending notes from heaven. And they just flutter down from heaven, and you pick them up, and it says, and this one says truth. In other words, you guys are right. Really, the temple was destroyed, and you were exiled, and how many hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed because of idolatry. And you're right, I gave you the Yetzer for idolatry in order to give you reward. And I understand what you're saying. You don't want the Yetzer, you don't want the reward. I understand, says God. Good morning. Let me give you the... Sudena?
Sienna. Yeah.
And do you have the Professor Berkovitz handout?
No.
That we've been using? No.
Rochelle's working something out for me, whether I come to this one or the other one.
I understand. I hope you come to both.
Come to this one. We'll take a vote.
Okay. In parentheses, the Talmud adds, Rabbi China said, one may learn therefrom the seal of the Holy One, blessed be He, is truth. End parentheses. Listen to this. They ordered a fast of 3 days and 3 nights, whereupon He was surrendered to them. In other words, God decided to give in, to give them the Yetzer Hara for idolatry to do what they want. And if they want to kill it, they can kill it. Okay?
It's interesting, after the Babylonian captivity, we no longer had a problem with idolatry.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
Except this is based on a certain historical truth, that if we learn the history of the Second Temple, and again, this is written in the beginning of the Second Temple, the Jews no longer had a problem with idolatry. They no longer worshipped idols. They did other sins, don't worry about it. But the sin of idolatry was gone. Now, we can explain that by all different types of anthropological, historical, sociological phenomena that were happening in the ancient world. But the rabbi's translation of that into spiritual truth is that the Yetzer for idolatry was killed. And how did it happen? This is the story of how it happened.
At least among us, not amongst...
At least among us.
Not amongst the Gentiles.
Right. So, he came forth from the Holy of Holies like a young fiery lion. There was the Yetzer personified as young fiery lion, and was lying in the heart of the Jewish people in the temple, the rebuilt temple. And now, when they prayed to God, and God said, I'll give it up to you, so he runs out, the Yetzer runs out, like a fiery young lion. Of course, fiery, that's the Yetzer Hara, it's full of fire, it's full of passion, it pushes you to do things, it's impetuous, it's a young, fiery lion. Thereupon the prophet said to Israel, this is the evil desire of idolatry. There it is right in front of you. As it said, this is wickedness. A quote from a verse in Zechariah. And they took hold of, as they took hold of him, a hair of his mane fell out. He raised his voice and it went 400 parsecs. So they captured it. They can kill it right now. Whereupon they said, how shall we act? Perhaps, God forbid, they might have mercy upon him from heaven. In other words, if we just hold it in our hands, who knows, another second, God might change his mind and let it go. We better do something quickly. The prophet said to them, cast him into a leaden pot. It's like...
What prophet was that?
It was probably Zechariah.
Zechariah,
right?
Yeah.
Cast him into a leaden pot, closing its opening with lead. Because lead absorbs the voice, as I said, and he said, this is wickedness, and he cast her down in the midst of the measure, and he cast the weight of lead upon the mouth thereof. That's the same verse from Zechariah. So it's like Superman, like it's kryptonite, like you have to put it in a lead pot. No one's laughing.
You change sex there.
Where?
And he cast her.
Okay, that's the verse. That's a quote from the verse. But
okay, I just wanted to clarify.
I didn't notice.
Evil was feminine.
Of course.
So anyway, that's the end of the first part of the Talmudic passage. And indeed, it ends here. We'll go on, but it ends, this part ends, by saying that the Yetzer Hara for idolatry was killed. And let me just sum up the takeaway from here that I think is important for us. When the rabbi said, we want neither it nor its reward. In other words, there you have the clear, clear statement that Yetzer Hara is the source of reward. That Yetzer Hara is the source of good. Yetzer Hara is the source of meaning. And if you get rid of it, you've gotten rid of a certain level of meaning. And indeed, what that means is that the monotheism is now that much less laudable. Because the option to not believe in monotheism, to believe in polytheism, the option is gone. The Yetzer is gone. The desire is gone. The allure is gone. But the rabbis are willing to live with that. To apply that to faith after the Holocaust, here's a source for Professor Berkovitz's statement that you can't have good, that is to say reward, without the option of doing bad. It's right there in the Talmud.
Several sentences farther on.
I'm about to read them right now. Let's read the rest of the sentences. Says the Gemara, as we continue on, they said, since this is a time of grace, in other words, we're doing good, God, let us kill the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. Let us pray for mercy for the tempter to evil, which is a reference to the Yetzer Hara for arayot, for sexual immorality. One down, right? We got the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. Let's go after now the Yetzer Hara for sexual immorality. And then we'll have a perfect world.
They have murder, you see.
Very good. Right. Chip remembers there are three cardinal sins, murder, idolatry, and sexual licentiousness. The rabbis here are working on two.
Two out of three.
They prayed for mercy, and he was handed over to them. The Yetzer Hara for sexual morality was in their hands. God gave them the Yetzer Hara to do what they want with it. Now look at the next line. He, the prophet, said to them, realize that if you kill him, the world goes down. The world will be destroyed without the Yetzer Hara for idolatry.
That's a profound
For sin, for sexual sin. That is a tremendously powerful line. We need the urge to sin for idolatry and incest and rape and all these terrible things. We need that Yetzer Hara. Without it, the world will not exist anymore. Why? Well, one reason we read already. Because without the desire and the option and the real possibility to do evil, there's no meaning to good. And apparently the rabbis feel that the Yetzer Hara for sex is more sensual in the world than the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. The world can still exist without the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. Okay, so Judaism will be a little bit less meaningful, right? Monotheism will be a little less meaningful, but we can live with that. But without the possibility of sexual impropriety, the world goes down. Wow, that's really powerful. And then there's explanation. They imprisoned him for 3 days, that is to say the Yetzer Hara for sin, for sexual sin. They looked in the whole land of Israel for fresh egg and could not find it. You see what it's saying? If there's no Yetzer Hara for sexuality, then there's no Yetzer for procreation. There's no Yetzer for creativity. There's no power in the human heart to go and procreate, to fill the world, to be creative, to do new things, to establish new things, to take risks, to make more and more human beings, to make more and more life, to improve life. In other words, without the Yetzer Hara for sexual sin, you lose Bill Gates. You lose the desire to make the world a better place. You lose Bill Clinton. You really lose Bill Clinton. Because if Bill Clinton didn't have the Yetzer Hara from Monica Lewinsky, he wouldn't have the Yetzer to be president. He wouldn't have the Yetzer to change the world. He wouldn't have the Yetzer to do good. Because it's the same inner power. It's the same fire. It's the same lion. If you kill the Yetzer Hara for sex, you kill the desire of human beings to get ahead, to establish themselves, to make a name for themselves, to make a mark, to make more children, to make more possibilities, technology, medicine, reaching the stars with the spacecraft. It's all gone. It's all gone. Unless you have that Yetzer. And here the rabbis are saying, stop talking really about Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov. There aren't two Yetzerim. There's not an evil desire and a good desire. There's one desire. It's the desire to create. It's the desire to make a mark. It's the desire to assert yourself. It's the desire to be powerful. It's the same desire. And if you are willing to live in a world without the near impeachment of Bill Clinton for Monica Lewinsky, then the world is finished. There has to be such a possibility. There has to be such a Yetzer.
It's what you do with it.
It's what you do with it.
What channel? How you?
It's how you challenge it.
Channel it.
Channel it. Shep is 100% right.
What you're describing is what an individual makes his evil or good choices, as far as he himself is concerned. You are not describing the evil where somebody decides to be evil and harm other people.
But it's perhaps it's part of the same thing.
How can it be the same thing when, you know, like in Bill and Monica Lewinsky, nobody was really hurt?
No one was hurt. I can think of three people who are hurt.
Yes.
Hillary Clinton, Monica Lewinsky, and Bill Clinton.
And Jill Chelsea. And their daughter.
Yeah.
The whole nation was.
The whole nation.
She's right. Yeah,
No. I see Jim's point. On the one hand, if you take Bill Clinton or Jack Kennedy, who also had his sexual problems, desires, but they were people who were also motivated to do good. All right. If you take Saddam Hussein. We'll leave the Holocaust out of it because I think that's just too big to deal with. If you take the president of Syria, these are people who do evil and deliberately do evil.
I understand.
That becomes a prime motive for them.
Yeah, but the point that I'm trying to make is that if the world didn't have that Yetzer, that drive, then Bill Gates wouldn't have it, and Saddam Hussein wouldn't have it, and Bashar Assad wouldn't have it.
Yeah.
It's the same drive. It expresses itself in different ways. Some people only for good, some people only for evil, and some people for both.
Well, let me take it a step further, then. Is Berkowitz saying not only does the individual need it, but the world needs it?
Yes, the world needs it, I think.
This is a very Freudian also, it seems like. The same drive that's at the root of a lot of good, it seems very... Freud wouldn't have put it in those terms.
No, Freud had his own problem with sex.
Oh, yeah.
I don't mean with his own particular behavior, but...
I understand. I understand.
Yeah.
But then, of course, you bring up the continual thing where people call it evil, that we dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In fact, the Reformed Prayer Book still calls that an evil deed. On the other hand, if Harry were here, he said he's alive because of it. So So was that evil or not evil at that point in time?
I understand.
We've touched on this many times in the past, and other goodness means nothing in the absence of evil, more or less. Always rejected that, trying to think of examples of our situation in which it was a philosophy that the reward for doing good is doing good without evil being introduced at all. That the notion that you can do good, whatever that might mean, help someone, for example, is the satisfaction of knowing that you help someone without the threat of evil having anything to do with it, or the presence of evil having anything to do with it. It is really a very disturbing thing to me to consider that the premise is based upon the presence of this evil inclination that is, in fact, the way that we've been defining it, more powerful than the good inclination. In fact, you've not even separated them. You've brought them together as an inclination, or the motivation for inclination. So
now I do remember now that you have made this point in the past. But since I don't remember what you said, then let's have the discussion again.
Well, what I mean is, I'm trying to think of a historical person, a real person, like Mother Teresa, that's an example, or what's the name of the Mother's Rabbi in New York?
Schneerson.
Rabbi Schneerson, for example. People who seem to be motivated to do good by virtue of the inherent nature of doing good. I mean, I don't see in these two little examples where this philosophy would work for them. I mean, is the motivating, that evil is the motivating factor for doing what they are doing, this inclination, at least the other half of it.
I just want to respond a little bit. Or
I guess you're saying don't put it all in one basket and say, well, the bribe is what's important, whether it's good or whether it's not so good. I don't agree that the evil inclination is stronger than the positive inclination. That's to be argued.
Yeah, I didn't say that. Do you want to respond?
I guess the point is that we're disagreeing with Berkowitz.
Goodness gracious, how could you do that?
No, but the point is you're interpreting.
I'm interpreting him.
You're interpreting your understanding of Berkowitz, and if that's an accurate interpretation, then we're at the very best, we're uncomfortable with Berkowitz's position.
I'm sorry to hear that, because I'm enamored by it.
No, I'm not sorry to hear for it. That's a good Jewish trait.
No, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Mark? I think it goes back to a level just above that, in that we talk about evil and we talk about good, and we talk about one's existence is dependent on the other's existence. We can't say that you have a good inclination or an inclination to do good until we define what good is. And you can't define good without saying the lack of good is evil. So therefore, you have to have evil if you have something that you call good.
Well, I would just say, just quickly, that there could be levels of goodness.
And the bottom level is?
Good, but not maybe as good as a level above it.
Well, what does that mean, good?
Well, I mean, let's say that you clothe the hungry. That's
you,
a good.
You consider that to be good.
I mean, you clothe people who don't have food. That's good. But maybe feeding them is even better than that, a higher level of goodness. Or maybe providing them with the means to earn their own living and provide for their food and clothing is even better than that.
But
and so
how do you define murdering your brother? Is that a lower level of goodness? goodness without evil.
Wait a minute, I don't see that. I'm trying to make an argument that you could.
I know.
I mean, I know that there's evil.
Okay. You can have evil without, you can have good, all goodness. Can you have total goodness and no evil?
That is what I would think is the ideal world, the thing that the Torah has a prescription for in order for, if followed, would in fact result in exactly that. Goodness, because here's the formula. I gave it to you, follow it.
Okay, but the formula says that you shouldn't murder.
Right. It is.
So when you say that you're going to have rules and a definition of goodness, it has to be relative to something. And what is the something? The something is evil. We've got a yin and a yang going here.
No, I think...
I don't know.
Let me try to interpret what I think Berkowitz is saying. God says man has to have choice in order, I'm simplifying, in order to be fully human. Then man is going to live on a continuum with evil, with good at one end and evil at the other. You can reverse him if you want. And he's going to live on that continuum. And the struggle is going to be closer balanced on the good side than on the bad side. They're not opposites. They may be polarities, but they're on the same continuum for man. I think that's what he's trying to explain. And God has to stand aside in order for man to be man. Otherwise, if there's no choice, then, to quote Rabbi Harav Schlesinger, man becomes a robot.
An automaton.
An automaton.
Yeah. Yeah, wait a second. We had in that corner and then over here. Okay. Etty.
Our rabbi in our synagogue says that Jewish religion is a religion of hope.
Of hope.
Okay? So, what I think is Rabbi Berkowitz is trying to dig all kinds of sources to find something to make us feel good after that horrible thing of the Holocaust. That will give us faith so we can continue. It doesn't mean that he's right or wrong, but he tries to make it logical, and that's what this is all about, I think.
I hear.
Okay.
So the traditional view of heaven is where there's no choice because it was all good. So there's no choice.
Indeed. Actually, we talked about that last week, I think. But were we to envision a afterlife in which there's no possibility of evil, then you're right. Then there's no possibility of good there.
No misvote. No.
Yeah.
You can't define good.
You can't define good there.
You can't discern it because there's nothing to compare it to.
100% true.
I rest my case.
The problem with that is other people decide and define what is evil for their own purposes. Like this last week, the heads of the Protestant religions in the United States have decided that Israel is evil. And you're increasingly seeing that throughout the rest of the world, they're defining Jewish and Israel as evil, which puts us basically at a we're at a crosswalk with the fact that there will be no interdenominational discussions anymore. The Protestants decide they're not used to that, they're not interested in talking to Jews anymore.
Okay.
Okay.
That's a different subject.
Yeah, it's a complex subject.
Okay. Of course, I have an urge to speak also, but perhaps I will restrain myself.
That's great.
Mighty of you.
Very godlike of you. Very godlike of you, Rabbi.
We're reading on.
That was a scary development.
Oh, yeah. It sounds like
so. We're reading at the top of paragraph, the very end of that paragraph, four lines from the end of the top paragraph, after it says they couldn't find a fresh egg.
Oh, yeah.
The single page. Do you have one?
No.
Thereupon they said, "What shall we do now? Shall we kill him? The world would then go down. Shall we beg for mercy?"
Half mercy.
a half mercy, thank you, they do not grant halves in heaven. That's a great line. That really sums up everything we've been saying. There's no halves. In other words, you can't have good without evil. That's what it means. There's no halves. You can't divide up the whole. You can kill the Yetzer Hara. God's willing to kill it. But you've killed the world as we know it. Or you can keep the Yetzer Hara, and then you have to struggle with evil. There's no halfway. And Professor Berkowitz, therefore, is saying, in theory, you can have a world without the Holocaust. But do you really want such a world? When I say without the Holocaust, without the possibility of a Holocaust. Because that's the world without the possibility of Mother Teresa. That's the world without the possibility of light, without the possibility of good, without the possibility of any appreciation at all. It's the world of robots. And that's the choice. And according to this passage, God knows that's the choice. And the rabbis know it's the choice. And a conscious decision has been made to live in the world as we know it, with all the possibility of evil, because that grants all the possibility of good. What a powerful passage.
I'm just thinking, we have a prayer in the liturgy, Elokai Neshama, that the soul came pure from thee.
The early, before the morning prayer, Neshama said, Natatala.
Yeah, and so that it became pure. In its original, it was pristineness. It was pure, and then somehow it got sullied by.
Look, there's lots of different philosophies embedded in Jewish literature. I don't really.
Okay, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry.
That perhaps it contradicts. Doesn't matter.
We'll stick with this. Yeah.
Okay, so what I guess we're hearing is that there's black and there's white, but that we live in gray, which is a combination of all black. The Bible says God will...
No, he said he will no longer destroy the whole world after the flood.
That, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he can't change his mind.
Okay.
He changes his mind a lot. But the bottom line is that we live today in a world of gray. There's evil and there's good. And it's not that extreme. There are people that are evil, but they still do good.
Of course.
So we live in a land of grayness, which to me, man has a choice, but inside all of us, what Berkowitz is saying is a little bit of both.
I think that's Moe's continuum.
But what allows there to be the white is the black. Right? That's the point.
Well, what allows there to be black is also the white.
Yes. And what allows there to be gray needs to have both of them, both the white and black.
Absolutely. Oh, I'm sorry. And then, who's first? I don't know.
I was first, actually.
Okay.
I mean, I would like to kill the evil inclination first, but I guess when he says they don't grant halves and have rid of that inclination, it seems like that would save an awful lot of turmoil.
Let's think about that. If we got rid of the evil inclination to murder, what would be the downside? I mean ethically.
Yes, I mean that.
I mean ethically.
Yeah, that's
if we had total respect for the lives of our fellow men.
No wars.
No war, right?
We have very, very, very large prisons.
Prisons.
What? We wouldn't kill anybody. We would just lock them up for the rest of their life.
Yeah, but they didn't kill anybody in the first place.
When you're talking about murder, because the seventh or eighth commandment is thou shalt not murder. Is the correct translation, as I understand it from Hebrew. Does that apply to war?
Okay, Mo, but that's not the matter that was being brought up.
So you're saying if one person kills another, that temptation or cause is
out of bounds now. That disappears.
But I think the point of the passage is that there's almost no such thing as getting rid of any aspect of the Yetzer Hara without losing something on the other side of the
scale.
What about
getting rid of idolatry?
I understand.
What did we lose?
We lost the meaning, the deeper meaning of monotheism. Because if there's no Yetzer, think of the power and the meaning and the satisfaction, to use a word that Jay used earlier, of Avraham Avinu discovering there was one God. Think of the challenges he had to overcome. Think of the tremendous, tremendous meaning of that discovery for himself and his fellow. But if there was no possibility of idolatry, no yetzer to find other gods, no human need to have a God that's close and tangible and physical, then the power of monotheism would be gone. Because there wouldn't be any other possibility. It wouldn't be a choice. It wouldn't be a choice. Just think of people of faith who've discovered God, who've been born again, to use a Christian term. That sense of discovery, that sense of being close to something they weren't close to before, that sense of going against the grain of their friends and their family and having a new sense of meaning in life, they would all be gone if everyone had it.
Somehow or another, I don't find that particularly satisfying. I got to tell you that either we consider the human inclination or human passion, whether it be towards good or towards evil, the existence of it as a whole has to remain as a whole. I don't think, even though the implication here is there's a difference between sexual morality and idolatry, I think the argument is that there is none, and that we have not gotten rid of the desire for idolatry because we've changed our idols. Now money substitutes for other things. So
you know what? I think this man is right.
I don't think you can divide the human passion into segments and get rid of a part of it.
I think you might be right about that. Yeah. I've been having those feelings as we've been talking about this for the past half an hour. There's so many people want to talk. I think Jay was earlier.
Just as I was making an argument about perhaps there are different levels of good that could exist without evil, suppose that we say there could be different levels of evil. It's almost a corollary of what Carol Ann said, just get rid of one thing. So suppose evil was a minor infraction. Wouldn't that be enough to then have a baseline for which you could compare good, but evil would not extend to something like the Holocaust? It wouldn't have to be that evil. It could be just a little evil.
Yeah, I think not. I think that if there's only the possibility of a little evil, then there's only possibility of a little good. And the major goods of this world would be erased.
Two things. Number one, the creation story sets the stage for the presence of evil, because what God says after Eve eats whatever the fruit was, now man will know the difference between, will know about good and evil, right?
What's the line exactly? I'm trying to remember.
No, in the creation story, after Eve...
They will become like us.
Eating from the tree of knowledge.
They will become like us, knowing
good and evil.
Right.
But the point is, Berkowitz is presenting us with a position that says God decides not to intervene because he wants humanity, he wants man to be fully human, with full choice, the ability to make choose, the ability to do good or
to create,
do bad.
You
can't look, there's the prohibition to idolatry only applies to Jews or to B'nai Noach, right?
It's not, that's not.
But the ultimate
clear.
Goal, the ultimate goal is to get rid of idolatry. But if we look at the world of the 21st century and walk into a Hindu temple, we'll see idolatry manifest, because and a lot of us would say, as we did a couple of weeks ago, if we walk into a Roman Catholic church and we see the never mind, you don't have to walk into a church. If you're a Catholic, you can pray to, you can worship saints.
Well, they say that the saints direct you
No, never mind. It's my view. All I'm right. talking about myself right. as a Jew. As a Jew, I have to look at that and say, they're not worshiping God. They're
okay.
worshiping a saint. They're worshiping a human being. And there's hundreds of them around now.
Yeah.
But idolatry is the ultimate one of the three ultimate
cardinal sins
that a Jew may not be involved in.
Great, you got it. Okay.
Yeah.
I always thought the difficulty determining.
You always thought
the difficulty determining between evil and good is represented by one person, Wernher von Braun. Because Wernher von Braun, when he was in Germany, he developed rockets, and they used the rockets to help destroy Great Britain. So what did we do as soon as the war was over? We took Wernher von Braun and said, come over here, and develop rockets to go to the moon. So he was doing the same thing.
Right, the same Yetzer could be used for good or for evil.
That's
the same
right.
Yetzer to create.
So was he good or was he evil?
And the answer is he had the Yetzer, and it depends on those who harness it for good or evil, right? That's the point that we're making. The Yetzer itself is not good or evil.
No, you can argue otherwise. He was evil because he allowed his, what he did,
creation
to be used for evil.
Okay.
Began before
well,
Russians.
We always have that issue, like the people in Nagasaki would not think that the dropping of the atom bomb was good as their flesh peeled away. We thought it was because it ended the war and kept more people elsewhere from being killed. So it's such a complex thing. I mean, it's not just real clearly set out.
That's certainly true, but I think the argument that we're involved in doesn't hinge upon defining what is good and what is evil.
Right.
We're working just with the relationship between the concepts of good and evil. And the idea being that the existence of one concept is what allows the other concept to exist, whatever the content of these concepts might be.
What Berkowitz seems to be saying is you can't blame God. What you can blame God for is giving us the ability to choose.
Yes, that's what he says, black and white.
I think that's Berkowitz's whole thesis.
We can blame. We can both blame and praise God for that. Yes.
What we blame God for is not intervening.
Well, Berkowitz.
All right, good and evil, and then some horrible like the Holocaust, and the blame is where were you?
But I think you missed the beginning of the class. But the whole point is that God cannot intervene without destroying the very fabric of human autonomy, which is the whole meaning of his creation.
It's the whole meaning about being created in God's image, is to have the autonomy.
Yes.
It's just like God's autonomy.
Jay.
Okay. I found a good argument.
Uh-oh.
Of goodness in the absence of evil. It's in Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
All right, good.
And God said that the light was good. And then again, another couple of paragraphs later, I've lost my place here, but he also repeats that, and I didn't have the time to read through the entire creation scene. So my argument is that, in this instance, God created something, and he said it was good. He didn't say it was good in relationship to evil. He said it was good. I think that this is an argument for the presence of goodness without without evil to counterbalance it or to compare it to. It was good because it was good.
So I do not agree.
Absolutely.
Because
that's something that God did.
Had the world been eternal, your case perhaps could stand. But the whole creation story seems to be creation when before creation there was nothing. And the point is that compared to the nothing that existed beforehand, the light that was created was good compared to the darkness that existed before creation. As the first verse says, that there was choshech al penei tom, that there was darkness on the face of the void. And then there was light.
But darkness does not necessarily equal evil. It's just darkness.
Okay, but no.
Yeah.
That's it.
Wait a second.
I'm saying that you wouldn't say, using your argument, that prior to this, in this void that existed before, that that was necessarily evil. There was no good or evil at that point. Perhaps.
Yeah, but we're saying God is saying that existence is good compared to non-existence.
True. But non-existence doesn't necessarily mean evil. I'm saying that goodness can exist, perhaps in comparison to other things, but it doesn't have to be compared to evil.
Okay, goodness without evil can exist in a divine world, but in a human world, it can't.
I accept that.
Right. Okay. Because God
is
says...
Amendment? Wait,
God,
is that an amendment? I accept your amendment. It's already an amendment.
Okay. James, you can accept that, then we're finished. In other words, to say what Joe is saying in a different language, good can exist without evil. As long as you say good, you don't mean ethical good.
What do you mean by good, then?
Divine good. Divine.
Use the word divine. But here, good, in the verses you quoted, good means ontological good. It means good in the sense of existence is better than non-existence. Right. But when we're talking about good in this framework here, we're talking about ethical good. I think we're talking about ethical good. Right. And ethical good cannot exist without the possibility of ethical evil, which we call evil. Yeah.
But Jay is stopping at a convenient place in the creation story. Because you got to ask a question. It's a real question. Why does God have those two doggone trees in the Garden of Eden? The tree of life that we never get to eat from, and the tree of knowledge, which contains the whole concept of good and evil as part of it. Why does God put it there and tempt and let Eve be tempted to eat from it?
Good, Mo.
God sets the whole thing up.
And from the beginning, we have free choice.
Okay, so it looks like we should go on. We're beating a good horse to death.
Right. I need to bring one thing up, which means good and evil. And this year, everybody knows there were 6 Nobel Prize winners in science. 3 of them were Jewish. So that was good.
Power to the
Jews.
Was
the fact that 3 were not Jewish evil?
We are... Okay, so now we're going back to the book, and the place we are in the book, Beit HaHolocaust, is where Professor Berkowitz has begun to segue from the first part of his argument to the second part of his argument.
Okay, so what page are we in?
107. I'm sorry, 109. So we've more or less finished, let's say, the first part of the argument. Now we're beginning the second part of the argument. In order to begin the second part of the argument, I'd like to read the Talmudic passage that he's basing himself upon, which means we're going to read exactly where we left off in the last five or six lines of the page, of the handout page. So remember the story, just to remind you very briefly. Moses had said, Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, V'Nara, the God great, mighty, and awesome. The word awesome was left out by Ezra. And the word... Sorry, did I say it right?
Yes.
I did. And the word mighty was left out by Daniel.
By Jeremiah.
Daniel. By Daniel. And then the Talmud says, how could it be that these words were left out? And it gives a twofold answer. One answer for each word. How is it that the word mighty was left out? I'm sorry. Take it back. These two words were left out. How could it be? And the answer given is because God didn't show himself to be awesome or to be mighty. And then the men of the great assembly came and put both words back. How could they put those words back when you don't see God's might and don't see God's awe? So the answer of how they could put back the word mighty was that God is being mighty by restraining himself. That we've talked about now. self-restraint, contraction, leaving room for human autonomy. But now the Talmud is going to talk not about the word mighty, but the word awesome. How did the men of the Great Assembly put the word awesome back? Where do we see the awesomeness of God in the world we live in? And the answer is as follows. It's the fifth line from the bottom, three words from the end of the line. Therein lie his awesome powers.
For what is this again? I'm sorry. I'm in the book. Page what?
No, not in the book.
Oh, the tape. I'm sorry.
Five lines from the bottom of the page, last three words. Therein lie his awesome powers. But for the fear of him, how could one single nation persist among the many nations? That's the line that the perverse can talk about now for 38 pages.
That's a proof of his awesomeness, the survival of...
The survival of the Jewish people, which Jay also objects to. I remember from last week. The claim is going to be, yes, God restrains himself. Yes, God doesn't do overt miracles. Yes, it's true, you can't directly and powerfully see God's hand in history, and the reason for all that is because he restrains himself, and that's his might, as we talked. However, if God were to completely and absolutely, without caveat, restrain himself and be involved not at all, then there'd be no Jewish people. This people is so unique and so small and so powerless and stands in such great opposition to the values of all the other nations that it had normal, human, non-divine history, be given a free reign, the Jewish people would have been destroyed 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 1,500, 2,000 would have been destroyed 2,500 years ago. It would have hardly gotten off the starting blocks. The fact that this people continues to exist, despite the fact, I understand, that it's despised and it's persecuted and it's exiled and it's murdered and it's Holocaust, the fact that it still exists, survive all those things, there's only one explanation. That a people this small, that stands in such great opposition to all the other nations of the world, the fact that we survive at all is a sign that somehow, somewhere, despite the fact that God is restraining himself, he's pulling some string somewhere. It's hard to see them. It's extremely hard to see them.
Those are the footprints of God that we see, the survival of the Jewish people.
That's what the Talmud says. Yeah. And that's going to be the foundation, the second foundation of the whole book we're reading, Faith After the Holocaust. That's going to be the second argument. Yes, the Holocaust took place, but the fact that a Jew survived it, that a whole nation survived it, and that the State of Israel exists, and the Jewish people exist after the Holocaust, there's no way to explain it other than to say that there's a hidden presence of God in history. So that's an introduction, and let's go back to the book. Page 109, in the paragraph that's in the second half of the page. We began to read about his argument last time, and now we're really going into it. Yet he is present in history. He reveals his presence in the survival of his people Israel.
Excuse me, are you on 109?
109.
Where? The
beginning of the second.
Okay, I got it.
Therein lies his awesomeness, and that word awesomeness comes from the Talmudic passage we're now looking at. God renders himself powerless, as it were, through forbearance and long-suffering, yet he guides. How else could his powerless people have survived? He protects without manifest power. Because of that, Israel could endure God's long silences without denying him. Because of the survival of Israel, the prophets could question God's justice and yet believe in him. The theology of a God unconvincingly present in history alone might not have sufficed. Means, had we only had the theology, the idea that God guides without direct overt presence, that wouldn't be enough. But we have proof. The proof is that we're in this room today, he says. It's not just a theology, it's empirical. The dilemma cannot be resolved on an intellectual level alone. Again, there has to be an empirical proof. We couldn't say this had we not been alive. And indeed, neither Jeremiah nor Habakkuk nor even Job were given an intellectually valid answer. The Talmudic conclusion was correctly reached: God was silent. Yet the dilemma was resolved not in theory, but strange enough, in history itself. Because again, we're here. Now historical facts that conflict with the philosophy of history, ipso, meaning of itself, refute that philosophy. When history stands in contrast to philosophy, history wins. That's empirical truth. But historical facts, however numerous, cannot refute another historical fact, however irregular and solitary. In other words, we have 99 historical facts that prove that God is dead. But we have one historical fact that flies in the face of that, which is that the Jewish people are still alive. And that is what proves for oppressive workers that God is not dead. He's simply restraining himself, but in the background, he's pulling some strings. It is indeed true, as was seen by Jeremiah, Habakkuk, and others, that a great deal of the historical experience contradicts some essential Judaic proposition of a just and benevolent providence. The way of the wicked often succeeds. God is much too often silent. But it is even more true that, seen in the light of the generally observed facts and presses of history, the very idea of a people of God, of constituting a people on the basis of commitment to do the will of God and the belief that life and death are determined by the ethical categories of good and evil, was a fantastic proposition. That there should be a Jewish people with its ideals is unbelievably fantastic. All history advised against it. We should have been destroyed if we have such ideals that fly in the face of what most other nations go by, which is power. From the very beginning, all the powers and processes that determine the course of history were poised to render its materialization, in other words, the materialization of this people, impossible. Indeed, had it all been only an idea, a theology, a philosophy, the testimony of the facts of history would have rendered the concept of a people of God and the proposition on which it was to be based ridiculously absurd. However, this fantastic concept became itself a fact of history. The people of God did come into being. It entered history. It became itself a historical reality, exercising great historical influence and demonstrating mysterious survival power. It has all been quite irregular. It is all in conflict with the rest of historical experience, yet itself a fact of history. I know there have been so many historians, Jewish and non-Jewish, in the past 100 years who have pointed out that Jewish people shouldn't be here today. It flies in the face of all historical reality, all historical rules. But the fact that we're here says something. Right. Professor Arnold Toynbee wrote about it.
Toynbee was kind of anti-Semitic.
Yeah, despite this anti-Semitism. Right. Paul Johnson, you know, the great work of history today, Paul Johnson's work about the Jews, we shouldn't be here. There is this difference between a fact and an idea. The more irregular an idea is, i.e., the less it is in harmony with the generally prevailing principles relevant to it, the less the likelihood that it is valid and true. The same may be said of a philosophy of history. The more it's contradicted by historical experience, the less tenable it is. But a fact obeys the opposite rule. The more irregular it is, the more unique it is, the less in keeping with what is generally observed and experienced, the greater is its significance. The more intensely a unique historical reality is disavowed and challenged by the overwhelming force of a universal historical experience, and yet is able to maintain itself into survival, conflict, and all challenges, has by its very staying power proved its unique validity, vitality, as well as the validity of the principle which it proclaims. Such a unique and absurdly irregular historical fact has been the people of God. But because it is historical fact of inexplicable surviving power, the more it is challenged by the facts of universal history, the more it is confirmed. And the unique stands which it takes simply because it does take that stand and survives in spite of it all. Jeremiah could face with complete intellectual honesty the unpleasant fact that the way of the wicked does prosper, without embracing it as an ultimate truth in history upon which to base a Machiavellian type of history. He could do that because the reality of Israel, notwithstanding all its contemporary misery, pointed as a fact in the opposite direction. Already in the time of Jeremiah, the Jewish people shouldn't have been here. Right? Nations throughout the Middle East were being destroyed in his time and not being resurrected. Nations no bigger than us. The rabbis of the Talmud could speak of the silence of God at the time of the destruction of the temple and the state, and yet remain true to his word, because notwithstanding the Chorban, the destruction, Israel survived, remained historically viable, full of future expectation.
But what it ignores is what's happened in 2,500 years. The Jewish people were in Babylon for 2,500 years. They were in Alexandria for 2,000 years. They were in Libya for 2,000 years. They were in Poland for 1,000 years. But no longer are they in any of these countries. They're all gone.
There's a remnant that survives.
Historically, things have been a dramatic change. The Arab world for 2,500 years would accept Jews living among them, and now they don't.
But the people of Israel as a people is still here. Not only still here, it's now where it always wanted to be.
Yes and no, because particularly the Zionist ideal, and you're a Zionist, is the ingathering of the exiles. The people from Libya, Morocco, and Tunisia, and certainly the Jews of Poland and Russia that remained alive and chose to do so, are now in Israel.
On the other hand, the Arab world, the Muslim world, accepted Jews among them for 2,500 years, and now they don't.
But those are all little details. We're looking at the big picture.
That is a big picture. To say there were 3 million Jews in Poland, and now there's 5,000. They were in Baghdad in 1922.
But, Jim, that's exactly the point. That there, in the life of the Jewish people, it's tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. That's what he said. God restrains himself. But the fact that despite all those tragedies, there still is a Jewish people, that is inexplicable. That's his point.
Jewish people with its own state now.
Is all the more so inexplicable.
Right.
I think in Frederick the Great of Prussia, during the Enlightenment, he was asking for a proof of God, and so one of his counselors said, "The Jews, Your Majesty, the Jews are the proof of God."
I'd like to see that.
Sure, I'll try to find it for you.
We'll read on?
We're letting it soak in.
Okay. This, however, means that a Jewish philosophy of history is not to be based on the teachings alone. It's not based just on theology, on intellectual things happening in the classroom. It's the reality of history. The teaching as such is contradicted by a great deal of historical experience, as Jim just said, tragedy after tragedy. But neither should Jews allow such conflicting evidence to sway them in determining their outlook on history, for such evidence itself, says Professor Berkowitz to Jim, so such evidence itself is contradicted by their own existence, by the historical reality of Israel, by the place of the Jewish people in history, by the survival of the people of Israel. Yes, by the fact that once again, as Mo said, this people of God is back in its ancient homeland in Zion and Jerusalem. It would seem to us that there are two histories, one that of the nations and the other that of Israel. The history of the nations is self-explanatory. It is naturalistic history, explainable in terms of power and economics. It is exactly in those terms that the history of Israel remains a sealed secret. It defies that kind of interpretation. The history of Israel alone is not self-explanatory. It testifies to a supra-natural dimension jutting into history. Now, if the two could have been neatly divided and separated from each other, things might have worked out quite nicely. There would not have been neither anti-Semitism, nor pogroms, neither ghettos, nor crematoria. But unavoidably, both histories, which really means the history of the world in which God is restraining himself, and the history of the world in which God is pulling one or two strings out of a million, both histories take place in the same time dimension and occupy the same space. Together they form the history of mankind. Of necessity, the two histories interpenetrate. Thus, in the naturalistic realm, occasionally the voice is heard, with a capital V, and a glimpse is gained of the presence of the supernatural in this world. On the other hand, the wild, unbridled forces of the naturalistic realm ever so often invade and wreak havoc in the this-worldly domain in which sustenance of meaning and purpose is drawn from the supernatural dimension. Jews are confused in our times because they imagine that the problem of Jewish faith arises from the conflict between Jewish teaching and Jewish or general historical experiences. In fact, the conflict takes place between two histories. There are two realms, the realm of the is and that of the ought. The history of the nations is enacted mainly in the realm of the is. It is naturalistic history, essentially power history. History of Israel belongs chiefly in the realm of the ought. It is faith history, faith that what ought to be, what ought to determine and guide human life should be and will be. Because that's the part of history that has God pulling a tiny amount of strings.
Is this the Berkovich ascribes this to the covenant, the survival of? He doesn't use that word covenant, that does he?
He tries it to God, and of course, the fact that God is connected to the Jewish people is a function of the covenant.
I would think so. Yeah,
that's what he's saying.
That's great.
Faith history is at cross purposes with power history, but history it is, because we see it in vague glimpses once in a while. As long as Israel lives, the ought holds on to reality because it be it only by the skin of its teeth. As long as this is the case, the ought has proved its vitality as a this-worldly possibility. It has found admittance into the realm of the is. As long as Israel is, the ought to is. Is the existence of the Jewish people is proof of the existence of something beyond power history. The existence of something that is in opposition to...
Not by power, not by might, but by my spirit. There
thank you,
go.
Chip.
There you go.
Thank you, Chip. Sure. Quoting from Zechariah. As long as Israel is, the ought to is. The supernatural has acquired a footing in the natural. As long as this is so, there is hope for both. For there is hope for the ultimate merge of the two realms, when the ought will be fully real and the real will be convincingly identified as the life, which is the good. In the meantime, the conflict obtains not between ideas and philosophies, which is easily bearable, but between fact and fact. Between the powerful reality of the is and the meaningful and mysterious reality of the ought. Since it is a conflict between fact and fact, history and history, reality and reality. The conflict is clash, a battle accompanied by untold human suffering. You know, I want to actually take this back in a certain sense to things we talked about in the past year. The distinction between individual divine providence and collective divine providence. Another way of saying what he's saying is that on the level of individual divine providence, you can't see God. There is no individual providence. People die. Lots of people die. There's lots of individuals who in their lives can't see God. And it's not they can't see God because they're blind, because he isn't there in their lives. In the lives of these individuals, he's not there. There's no individual divine providence. And all you see is tragedy after tragedy after tragedy from the point of view of the individual. But from the point of view of the collective, the very fact that the Jewish people is still here, and despite all the tragedies of the individuals, the Jewish people still exists after the Yom Kippur War, and after the Six-Day War, and after the Holocaust, and after the Chmielnytsky massacres, and after the Inquisition, and after the destruction of the Second Temple, and I forgot there's Crusades in the middle there, and this and that, and this and that, and that, the fact that after so many tragedies on the level of the micro, the fact that the macro is still here, it's unbelievable. And the truth is, the more micro tragedies there are, the greater is the uniqueness and inexplicability of the macro. There's one more paragraph in this chapter. Why has it been so arranged by the God of history? We may not find an explanation. Although I think his explanation has been pretty good.
Yeah.
Decisive is, however, the realization that no matter what our solution may be to our specific problems, it must not abandon the truth to which the reality of Israel testifies, the macro. No matter how silent God may ever so often be, and he means 99.9% of the cases, we have heard his voice, and because of that we know his word in the 1%. No matter how empty of God vast tracts of the wastelands of history may appear to be, we know of his presence as we stand astounded contemplating our own existence, the fact that Jewish people are still here. True, these are contradictory experiences which present the mind with a serious dilemma. But no matter how serious the dilemma, it cannot erase the fact of the enduring reality of Israel. Even if no answers could be found, we would still be left with the only alternative with which Job 2 was left. That is, of contending with God while trusting in him, of questioning while believing, inquiring with our minds, yet knowing in our hearts. And even as we search for the answer, praising him as the rabbis of old did, who is like you, and you, O God, mighty in silence.
Wow.
Right? As we talked. Wow. So I want to... Joe?
So what he's saying is there is a God. God does intervene, but there is no personal God.
He
doesn't say those words, but that you're right. That's what it seems to be that he is saying. I don't know if he would agree to that formulation.
But if we're talking about individual words, then that's what I call a personal God. If there's no providence with respect to the individual, then that's this.
But wait a second, Joe. You're right. There's nothing wrong that you said, but Professor Berkowitz wouldn't agree to that formulation for the following reason.
Mm-hmm.
God's mighty restraint is personal providence. Because that's what gives you the possibility of doing good as an individual.
Like, I never think about that. God's restraint is an example of personal providence.
Again, I'm being a little bit, I'm fooling around with semantics.
It's paradoxical, really.
Right? But on the level of the collective, God's providence is that he pulls a few strings every 100 years, right? One every 50 years, whatever it is, to make sure the Jewish people survives. And he doesn't pull those strings for any individual.
Okay.
But does that mean we should just accept the formulation that there's no personal providence? Yes and no. You said yes, and what you said is true. But you can also look at it on a deeper level, that the fact that God doesn't punish you as an individual when you do evil, that is his personal providence vis-a-vis you, allowing you to do good. Because you can only do good as an individual when you have the option of doing bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but God didn't give me that right individually.
I understand. But okay, let me say it then differently. You can have a large degree of direct gratitude to God for your life,
okay,
because he allows you to do evil and therefore allows you to overcome challenges and do good.
God gives you the right to choose.
I can be glad that God gave me the right. He gave me the right. She gave me the right.
No.
He gave me the right as a part of a collective.
Yeah, but
I can't say that I want to go tell or ask God to pull a string for me.
No.
Absolutely, you're right.
So
right.
That means that.
No. Let me put it differently.
Okay.
The Cowboys don't win or lose because God intervenes. It's because the team plays the way it does.
Want to say he's pulling a string for you by not pulling a string for you.
Because the greatest gift is the autonomy.
You don't pass your exam because God helped you.
But Mo,
you
how
pass
about
your
Hannah?
Exam because
Hannah,
you did it.
Hannah prayed for a child and God. I mean,
yeah. No,
but that's, yes or no, it means what you believe.
No, that's
but
Berkowitz.
No, there wouldn't be prayer.
No, but that's Berkowitz's position.
Good point.
No, I'm not arguing with your position.
Okay.
That's what Berkowitz is telling us.
Yeah.
And when we come to Buber, we'll argue about different things.
I don't think he's telling us about personal. He's just telling about history, a general recommend.
If God is capable of pulling invisible strings in order to perpetuate the collective Jewish existence, that means he's capable of pulling strings.
Absolutely capable, but he holds himself back.
Wait a minute. No, but he doesn't hold himself back because he does pull the strings to invisibly, incrementally, to help the Jewish people. Right? Collectively. That means that he's capable of pulling strings. All right? It would also mean you have to accept then, I would think, that he could easily, just as easily, pull a few strings to make the severity of the evil less.
Yes, but that would make the severity of the good less.
No, but that's a weakness in Berkowitz's argument.
I don't think it is.
No,
the argument is that God, the argument is that there's a balance, and God has found the proper balance of intervening. He has to intervene as little as possible to allow maximum autonomy, maximum good. He intervenes at the minimum level just in order to make sure that Jewish people survives. And at minimum level might be, you know, once in a blue moon. I can't define, obviously. But of course, I do understand what you're saying. Not that I don't understand.
Well, of course, you know. Of course, I haven't read all that he's written, but it seems like he's just addressing it to the collective, not so much the individual. But also, I could see, in a general sense, to allow the collective survival collectively, he's going to have to intervene on certain individual levels to allow certain events to occur to allow the survival of the community.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, but that intervention is with an eye, not to saving particular people because they deserve it, but perhaps randomly, just because at that moment the Jewish people needs to survive. I want to, yes, I have one thing to say at the end, so don't go away.
if we say that God doesn't intervene, what gives us the argument that he intervenes occasionally? The fact that we survive may just be because we have the strength to survive and have nothing to do with God.
Professor Berkowitz's argument is that according to all the laws of power history, the Jewish people shouldn't be here.
Well, according to all the laws,
why not?
It occasionally happen.
I don't know why it shouldn't.
The argument that the Jewish people, because of their faith in God, they survive, I could accept means to keep us alive. Why, if you give him the power to intervene minimally?
But he has the power, but he restrains himself according to
Berkowitz. He could restrain himself from keeping us to survive. And
yes, he could, but he wants the Jewish people to survive for his own greater needs in history.
To me, that's circular reasoning.
Okay, this is a class in which we disagree.
I mean, if we have this inner strength to do what we have to do to survive, people survive under the worst situations, and yet they survive.
Yeah, but not after 3,000 years under such conditions.
Well, people that have survived. I mean, the Chinese have been around forever.
Not under the same conditions, and not under the same minimal numbers. Chinese were big people with power.
In exile, without a state, without an army, without... Yeah.
But look, I'm not going to go through the whole thing.
Closing comment.
Yes, two things. First of all, there was a lot written. This is written from a theological point of view. There's a lot written you can find on the internet. Again, look for Paul Johnson. Look for Rabbi Nathan Cardozo. There's a lot. You can... Robert Gordis and his son...
it's his grandson.
Danny Gordis. They've written again and again and again about the quote-unquote miraculous existence of the Jewish people after 3,000 years of history. That's not what Professor Berkowitz is not writing a history text.
To let you know that I was married by Robert Gordis.
Okay.
In his congregation.
Robert Gordis.
Robert, yeah, the father.
Wow. Okay.
So,
what I want to say at the end is the following.
Grandfather.
Very rarely do I make personal confessions. But I would like to reveal that the material we're learning right now and last week really sums up a great deal of my personal spiritual life.
Yes.
And I'll say this briefly, that when I grew up, I grew up without any religious background, without any religious training. And my introduction to Judaism, to the Jewish people, was really through Zionism, through the Young Judea Youth Movement. And when I was in high school, I became very deeply involved in Zionism, and I went to Israel for a summer, and I went to Israel right after high school for a year. I became a Zionist. I became enamored by making the desert bloom, by the idea of socialism and kibbutz, a new state, a new ideals. I was hooked. But about at the age of 18, I came to the conclusion that my Zionism was akin to castles in the air, because I believed in the state of Israel, and I believed in making the desert bloom, and I believed in giving my American life up, sacrificing and going to Israel for this new state. But if it's not based on something that's founded in a greater truth, if it's not some metaphysical truth here, not some deep abiding obligatory foundation, then why sacrifice my life for that dot on the map in the deserts of the Middle East? And I came to the conclusion that if there wasn't something in Judaism that was a foundation of Zionism, then Zionism is not strong enough to change my life for. So where am I going to find truth in Judaism? So that's Torah, that's the Jewish religion. But I had no belief in God. I had no sense of any personal providence. I had no sense of any personal meaning. My life in America was fine. I wasn't searching for anything on a personal level, and I had no sense of divine revelation and no sense of any type of God intervening in my life. And as I began to study, all that I found, I would say, is exactly what we're learning about. I didn't find God on a personal level. I found God on a collective level, in the sense of the things we're talking about right now. And I came convinced that it was Zionism itself that proved the truth of Judaism, not the opposite way around. The fact that the Zionist movement is here after 2,000 years of exile, which came after 1,000 years of partial exile, the fact that we're still here, that is my proof that there's a foundation to Judaism. In a certain sense, Zionism is its own proof. The fact that we're still here, that proves that there's something to it. And that's been the foundation of my Jewish life since then. Exactly what we're talking about. That on the individual level, restraint, divine restraint. I don't feel, and I don't find the need to feel, any personal divine intervention in my life. But on the level of the collective, on the level of the awesomeness of God, that there's still a Jewish people, that's for me the link to all of Jewish history and all of Jewish meaning and all of Jewish literature. So that's my personal feeling. Doesn't obligate anyone, but it describes
really
life I live.
You really like Eliezer Berkowitz. You really like his.
It connects to my experience, and perhaps it's no coincidence. One of my first teachers in Judaism was his son.
Wow!
So I absorbed.
Wow!
So you're not a Chassid.
I'm not a Chassid, but I am. Of him.
Of him? No, you're one of his Chassidim.
It
looks like in God's personal intervention on the individual level.
An individual practical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a hard.
It is hard.
I can relate to that. Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
You ready?
Okay.
I'm going to take it.
Thank you very much.